The Midnight Myth Podcast presents The Wheel of Ka, an exploration into the writings of Stephen King. What started as two friends rereading The Dark Tower has turned into an exploration of Stephen King's writing writ large. This week, Steve and I discuss Finders Keepers.
The trunk is too light. Mar scrambles back to a sitting position with smears of dirt now sticking to his damp skin. He brushes his hair off his forehead with a shaking hand, leaving a fresh streak. The trunk is too light. He reaches for it, then draws back. I can't, he thinks. I can't. If I open it and the notebooks aren't there, I'll just snap. But why would anyone take a bunch of notebooks? The money, yes, but the notebooks? There wasn't even any space left to write in most of them. In most, Rothstein used it all. What if someone took the money and then burned the notebooks? Not understanding their incalculable value, just wanting to get rid of something a thief might see as evidence. No, Morris whispers. No one would do that. They're still in there. They have to be. But the trunk is too light. He stares at it, a small exhumed coffin tilted on the bank in the moonlight. And behind, it is the hole, gaping like a mouth that has just vomited something up. Morris reaches for the trunk again, hesitates, then lunges forward and snaps the latches up, praying to a god he knows cares nothing for the likes of him. He looks in. The trunk is not quite empty. The plastic he lined it with is still there. He pulls it out in a crackling cloud, hoping that a few of the notebooks are left underneath. Two or three, or oh please God, even just one. But there are just a few small trickles of dirt caught in the corners. Morris puts his filthy hands to his face, once young, now deeply lined, and begins to cry in the moonlight.
Hello, travelers on the path of the beam. What is up? Wheel of Ka is back. Derek and Steve coming to you pre-recorded from Delaware County, Pennsylvania.
Let's go.
I am so pumped. We are here to talk the second book of the Stephen King Bill Hodges trilogy, Finders Keepers. Ooh. I hope you've read it before you have tuned into this podcast. And I hope you listened to our podcast on Mr. Mercedes before you tuned into this podcast. I couldn't be more pumped in my bones to be back doing another Wheel of Ka with you, Steve.
So quickly.
I know.
So quickly.
I know. Buddy, how you feeling?
I feel good. I feel good. You know what's funny? I have nothing prophetic today. I just feel good.
Stiffy is good.
It's like the first time I feel like I haven't had some, you know, big existential crisis or something that I needed to talk about. But no, I feel good. I'm excited to talk the book. I can't believe we're back again for the third time in like 2 months, which is wild.
These books have been very, very easy to
read.
They're
quick. They're quick.
Especially when you're used to a Stephen King tome that's like 1,200 pages.
Yeah.
These little 650 page, they're like, oh, these are novellas.
Which again, 650 pages. Like that's not a small book, but for Stephen King it is.
Yes, for Stephen King and for Stephen King fans like us, it is a very small book.
It's like when we read The Mist. I felt like I read The Mist in 10 minutes.
I know, right? Like I sat down and it was over.
It was done.
I know. I couldn't agree more with that. I'm really stoked for it. I am really enjoying going through this Stephen King detective series. Mm-hmm. It's completely similar yet different from everything we've done thus far.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Stephen King continues to impress with not having yet, for me, a bad book.
Yeah.
There have been books I've loved to varying degrees. There have been some that I have respected but didn't love. But I've yet to encounter a book where I've thought, well, I just don't think this one's very good.
Yeah, I agree.
And
I agree.
This trilogy has been a blast so far.
It has been. It has been. It's very modern. You know, like it brings one of the things about this series of books is it happens in a time period that I'm alive and well for. You know, I'm not back in time. We're not in the 70s. We're not, you know, in the 60s and the 50s and the early 80s. You know, we're in 2009. which is right when I graduated college. So it feels, you know, it feels very, I mean, it feels like reality. It feels like it happened yesterday. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, I am totally with that.
Although it's almost 20 years ago. Isn't that nuts?
Time is a flat circle.
It's wild.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Completely insane. My niece will be starting high school soon, and I'm still not okay with that.
Yeah. But
yeah, time just, man, it moves.
Yep. It flies.
So what's this book all about? This is the second book in the Bill Hodges trilogy. This is about a villain named Morris who, as a young man in the 70s, kills an author to take possession of his unpublished books that he's obsessed with. After killing the author, he realizes he has to also murder the other people that perpetrated the crime with him so that he can have sole possession of these books, the extended Jimmy Gold series. Then when he realizes the books are too hot to sell from a book dealer, he goes on a bender, he rapes a woman, he fights a cop, he beats the woman, and he gets sentenced to a very long prison sentence. Mm-hmm. Before that happens, he buries the books with some stolen money from the author mm-hmm. under a tree in his backyard in this sort of like undeveloped land. Flash forward, a young man named Pete, whose father was injured from the Mr. Mercedes massacre in the first book, mm-hmm. finds the money and the books, decides he'll give the money to his parents in secret at 500 increments at a time, in a unmarked envelope. And meanwhile, he starts reading these books and falls in love and obsessed with these books. All things come to a head when Morris gets out of jail, realizes that the old book dealer, Pete, the kid who finds the books, is trying to sell the books to him so he can make money to send his sister to private school. When suddenly our Barbara, Bill, and Holly get involved, and they are on the case to try to help this kid, Pete. It all culminates in the books being burned. Morris, the guy who wanted to kill for the books, kills himself grabbing the burnt books. And Holly and Bill end up essentially saving the day and getting Pete out of
trouble.
And Jerome. Oh, my God. I forgot about Jerome. Yeah. And that's pretty much the gist of it.
Yeah.
That's the loosest recap that I can do. So I'm ready to talk about it, but before we dive too deep into it, if you are new here, thank you for joining us. If you're a returning listener, we love you.
Welcome.
Please check out our sister podcast, The Midnight Myth.
Oh, yeah.
Where my wife, Laurel, and I talk about history, mythology, and philosophy.
Yes.
Through the lens of popular culture, as well as check out my wife's podcast, Sleep and Sorcery, where she writes original sleep stories inspired by myth, fantasy, and folklore. So if you're an insomniac who loves podcasts and loves myth, folklore, great storytelling, it's a phenomenal podcast that will help you fall and stay asleep. She also has a book coming out. So if you go to
It's out.
The hard copy's out.
Yeah,
the soft copy's
it.
Not out. So you go to midnightmyth.com. And you can order her Sleep and Sorcery book.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
I mean,
it's brilliant.
Sleep and Sorcery has just blown up.
It's brilliant.
It is blown up. She's got a book. It's huge.
It's a niche. It's something she's incredibly good at. She's an incredible writer, an incredible actor. The way that she's able to put it out there, I'm not surprised. It's such an interesting way to have sleep, help with sleep. You know, like typically, like there's a lot of times we use fucking thunderstorm sounds and shit like that from when the baby was a baby. But I find Rebecca all the time, my wife, for those who are listening or not, we listen to it constantly. Like Laurel puts us to sleep.
You know, the one downside of being married to Laurel,
yeah.
I can't listen to it
because
when she hears it, she starts picking apart. I should have done this, what any podcaster, creative professional would do, which means we can never listen to it to fall asleep.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, you know what, though? It's great.
Well, because we do. We listen to it.
Because the podcast is blowing up and the book deal, it's amazing.
It's sweet.
Do you want to plug your podcast?
Yeah, there's a couple things I'd like to plug this time around.
Plug it.
So the podcast, the other podcast that I am a part of, which is still in development, sort of. Everybody's really busy. It's a D&D podcast musical called Mythic Thunderloot. So if you're a fan of rock music, if you're a fan of Dungeons and Dragons, if you're a fan of smoking weed, this is probably a good podcast for you. It's all original music and an original story written by our DM, Mike Doherty. And then it was created by myself and my closest friend from college, Jake Blauk. So it's check that out. It's the first half of the first season is out. The second half of the first season is being worked on. I promise. The second thing I'd like to plug for the first time.
Two plugs.
Okay. In a long time is if anyone is in the Philadelphia area, Delaware County area, on Friday, April 19th, I would love for you to come out and see my new band, Joe Grasso and the Ramblers, at the Media Theater, Friday night, April 19th. It's our first full band show. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I would love to see you out there.
Note to self, publish pod before April 19th.
Yeah, if not, no big deal. But that's it.
Awesome, dude. Multiple plugs. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I adore Mythic Thunderloot. Mm. Like, deep in my bones, adore it.
It's fun.
It is such a good time. If you like great music, great vocal actors, fun, insane, goofy stories, there's just not enough things done for joy.
Yeah.
For joy.
Yeah.
Right?
I agree.
I feel the joy, and I'm doing it for the joy to share the joy in this world.
I mean, it was born out of the pandemic for that reason. You know, just like three actors who were feeling the strain of like, shit, we cannot have our career. It's on hold. So what do we do, you know, in the meantime? I mean, sort of how this was born as well. You know, it's like, what do we do in the meantime to make sure we get our voice out there? You know?
Yeah. And it's fun. And it's so creative and different. Yeah.
Thank you.
I absolutely adore it. All right, so
let's talk some fucking Stephen King, bro.
Shit don't mean shit, bro.
Dude, shit don't mean shit. I'm going to go through this this background because there's actually not a lot for book.
Let's do it.
So this book is very much seen in the public eye as a very good bridge book, which makes sense, I completely agree. You know, it's not a masterpiece, but it's still a lot of fun, and it serves the exact purpose it's meant to serve, if you ask me. So it was published on June 2nd, 2015, which makes it the most recent book that we've read.
Woo-hoo!
Again, you said this earlier, it's the second book in the Bill Hodges / Holly Gibney trilogy, which we really get introduced to Holly in the first book, and she is in, I believe, now 5 Stephen King books. She's a character that he has really fallen in love with.
Yeah, so there's the third book in the trilogy, then there is The Outsider,
correct,
and then there's Holly.
Holly, the book Holly. The book received mixed to positive reviews. So I think, again, it's a middle book in a trilogy. It's not The Fucking Stand. It's not It. You know, like what you come to expect from Stephen King. But I think this was his first real attempt at a cohesive, correct me if I'm wrong, anybody out there, but a real cohesive trilogy. You know, that's not The Dark Tower.
Well, and that's 7/8 books. Slash, you know, 8 books.
You know, so
that's definitely not a trilogy.
Right. Like, so this being a story contained in 3 books, it's one of the first times he does it. Again, it received mixed to positive reviews. There was in her review for The Guardian, there's a writer, Allison Flood, praised the book as, quote, expertly plotted and a fresh take on one of King's favorite subjects, which is the relationship between a writer and their fans. Something that we know about Stephen King, that he is obsessed with, that he is a perfect, you know, I mean, person to look to when it comes to that, the most famous American writer.
Totally agree. Sense. And he writes about author and fan relationships.
Always.
Which is something that I think when you're done with this, maybe we should start unpacking that.
I think we should, because like there's a part of me that thinks like, I wonder if Stephen King has a fear of his fans and how much we gravitate toward him.
All right, well, we could, you are you done
yeah,
with
no, the no, hit? But yeah, basically it's really, I mean, there's not a lot. One criticism was that it was a bit of a somewhat outlandish plot. And like I disagree. I mean, it's Stephen King, for Christ's sake. Like, this is not a very outlandish book. To me, it was pretty cut and dry.
Somewhat outlandish plot.
Yeah, right? Like, I mean, what?
As a person that has spent the last 3 years of my life almost exclusively reading Stephen King.
But he tried this five.
Has it been five?
Try five.
This is the least outlandish plot.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't agree with it. Yeah,
I disagree with that criticism.
Yeah, I totally disagree with that idea personally. I think it's pretty, it's not a whodunit.
No.
In the respect that Mr. Mercedes is, who is the Mr. Mercedes, and how can the detective bring them to justice? You know, the detectives in this, Holly, Jerome, and Bill, they're not even trying to solve the murder.
No.
Right? Like, they're brought in to help a young man in crisis.
Right.
Who might be in trouble. So this is not a detective story in a conventional way at all. Mm-hmm. So I think the first one is, the second one, it lives in that detective universe. And if one were to put a gun to my head and say, what is the genre of this book? I would say, oh yeah, it's a detective book first and foremost.
The first one is.
Yeah, but this one is not as conventional of a detective book.
No.
You know, there are a few things that it does in particular in the first that remind me of a lot of other Stephen King books. The way the past and the present are like a circle, like Ka,
right,
happening simultaneously as it goes back and forth between Morris perpetrating the crime to steal the books, then killing the other murderers, then getting arrested.
You have an old man and a young boy.
And then Pete finding the books.
Right.
And then him going through what it means to live under the shadow after his father's body gets broken in the recession. What are they going to do?
And he just tries to do something good for his family.
And making the decision to, help his family out.
You know, like...
Yeah, so I feel like the way the first book, the way those two stories are chapter by chapter happening in two different times, I think is a lot like the way the Dark Tower starts and then goes backwards and then that. The way that it is about closing a time loop between what happens to the kids and then the adults and how those two stories are intertwined. So I feel intertwined. Thank you.
Yeah.
Why those stories are intertwined. And so I feel like there's this interesting thing happening with time, especially in the first part of the book. And I do think we see the evolution of Morris the villain from a very deeply troubled bad person into a full supervillain.
Yeah.
Like, we are reading his transition from a troubled youth into that. And that's interesting. What was the thing we wanted to unpack? Oh, the relationship.
The relationship of the writer to its fans. Yeah.
So tell me how you read that in this.
I mean, it's heavy. It's heavy. I mean, you have two characters, two male, you know, predominantly, I would say probably straight. They wouldn't probably consider themselves alpha males. Mm-hmm. But like, two men who are clearly influenced by this writer, very similarly. But they take different paths. You know, I mean, the obsession with this character of Jimmy Gold, the obsession, this male obsession, and I find this to be very American male. You know, we find these fictional characters that we can link to, that we can latch on to, and I mean, these two lose themselves in Jimmy's story completely and totally. One decides to murder the author and, you know, and take that path. The other decides to help their family. And I think it says something about what Jimmy Gold and the impression that that character made on these two men separately has to say, that like, a writer, an artist, a songwriter, a screenwriter, a playwright, you know, you're only writing from your perspective. You have no fucking clue how somebody is going to take your piece and interpret it for themselves. And this is the danger and the beauty of art.
Well said, dude. I totally agree with that. And I do feel like, if you look at Misery, a fan attacking an author.
Yeah.
If you look at Finder's Keeper, a fan attacking an author, there seems to be this similar link between them. And I think that is more superficial than literal, because Annie Wilkes is a full-on sociopath.
Yeah.
Who delights in being a serial killer.
Right.
Morris starts as just an angry young man.
Right.
Who's deeply troubled, who has an alcohol issue. Mm-hmm. He's got issues with his mom. And he finds his hero in Jimmy Gold. And he hates the end of that story and feels that it's wrong.
Yeah.
And in an era of fandom where fans feel so entitled to go out there and shred a piece of art because it wasn't what they expected the character to be. I felt that was very apropos of Morris being like, you know what? You did such a bad job ending the story. I'm going to get some of my other criminal buddies on the construction crew and we're going to rob you, but I really want to kill you for what you did to this character. And I think that also reminds me of this experience. I don't know how old you were when Fight Club came out.
Oh, I was old enough.
Where
I was a young teenager.
Where a lot of young men, young teenage boys, became obsessed with Tyler Durden.
Yeah.
And wanted to be like him. Mm-hmm. And just like, hold on. The whole point was he's the bad guy.
That's right.
The whole point is he needs to be stopped.
Right.
You know, and this idea of writing these charismatic, antisocial, psychopathic characters and the danger people identifying with them.
And men specifically, male characters.
Yes.
And predominantly.
I think in this case too, in reflecting on Finders Keepers, it's also white men.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, like
predominantly.
Yeah. And like in my life, it's been the white
it's always
men.
Been white men.
Tyler Durgans 100%. And Jimmy Golds.
That's right.
And Tony Sopranos.
Look at the majority of serial killers in this country, mass shooters. I mean, they are white men.
But here's my thing too. Morris is not Annie Wilkes.
No.
Annie Wilkes is pure evil.
Yes.
There's another where and when. There's another possible Stephen King world where Morris just has a tough relationship with his mom mm-hmm. and doesn't do the things that he does. We watch him get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
And to the point where he is almost described like he's the big bad wolf with his red lips. Mm-hmm. He almost enters a fairy tale level villain, but it takes him time to get there. That's not where he starts, which is very unique with Stephen King because usually his villains, his bad guys are like ancient evils, immortal. This is just a real troubled kid who got worse and worse as he got older.
Well, and that's, I feel like with King, it's one of two things. It's supernatural or it's hyper fucking real are your villains. There's nothing in between. They're either supernatural creations of horror or they're fucking Morris, everyday guys, Morris Bellamy, everyday dudes who are just, guys that work at the old Mac, just making sure people get their sets in on time.
Right.
You know?
Right. It's and in that respect, it's good. So, and I do think if we go back to what is Stephen King potentially saying about the author and the reader, I think he's saying the Morrises are the outliers and the Peters are the constant readers.
I would agree.
Let me pull a quote here for you.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
When he was a kid, Pete saw the notebooks only as buried treasure, his treasure. He knows better now, and not just because he's fallen in love with John Rothstein's nasty, funny, and sometimes wildly moving prose. The notebooks were never just his. They were never just Rothstein's either. No matter what he might have thought, hidden away in his New Hampshire farmhouse, they deserve to be seen and read by everyone. Maybe the little landslide that exposed the trunk on that winter day had been nothing but happenstance. But Pete doesn't believe it. He believes that, like the blood of Abel, the notebooks cried out from the ground. If that makes him a dipshit romantic, so be it. Mm. Sometimes shit does mean shit. Mm-hmm. And that is Pete transcending, I want to be like Jimmy Gold, to no, the story of Jimmy Gold matters to me, and I will rise above Jimmy Gold.
Yeah.
And that is him saying, just because you're a fan doesn't mean it's yours.
No.
In fact, quite the opposite. It's not the author's either, but everyone has a little part to play in this mm-hmm. thing called fandom. And you need to use your fandom to better your family first mm-hmm. for Pete mm-hmm. at the expense of himself.
Right.
And then to benefit himself.
Right.
And Pete is the reason I think this is not a cynical take on fandom the way Misery is definitely a cynical take on fandom.
Sure. Absolutely. And I do think, you know, one thing I wanted to bring up too, we've talked about it a couple times, and maybe we can transition into this, is what a question that I have is, what do you think the connection with, you know, Morris and his mother and Brady and his mother, like what Stephen King might be trying to say about that specific relationship?
Yeah, man, that's a good call out, because they, you know, both have...
It's very similar.
So Brady's relationship with his mother is demented
and
horrible and really hard to watch, or I'm sorry, to read. Watch if you're watching the show.
Morris's is very cynical, and it's like a competition almost for the two of them.
Morris, like, it reads to me that that night where Morris goes out and drinks and gets arrested, mm-hmm. that to me is the flip switch.
Yeah.
He goes out and drinks and doesn't get arrested. Maybe he grows up to be a normal dude.
Sure.
Right? But the fact that he goes out and gets arrested and then he's immediately in a juvenile penitentiary, he's getting raped there, like he's suffering these humiliations, I think set him on this path
sure.
where all he can ever see is Jimmy Gold.
Yeah.
Because I'd say a lot of us suburbanite middle-class white men mm-hmm. had this rebellious streak
sure.
like Jimmy Gold
sure.
and had heroes like Jimmy Goldman. I had a Sex Pistols, you know, poster in my bedroom when I was a teenager.
Sure.
Right? So I was like, never mind the Bullocks, man, you know?
Yeah.
Anarchy in the UK, bro.
Yeah.
So I was all about that, but I never had that experience, that institutionalized experience that then pushes him deeper and deeper into the angst. Yeah. I was able to, with the love of my family, surround myself with good friends, to not let that become my defining thing.
Right.
But Morris is developmentally stuck as an angry teenage boy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the other comment too about the character of Jimmy Gold and the fact that the only three books that the world has is with this self-centered asshole of a character, you know, in these other two books where he really redeems himself and then comes back into that fold, the world doesn't see that.
You know, so about the Jimmy Gold character. So,
well, I guess in the third book, he sells out.
Yeah, he becomes an advertising wreck.
Yeah, so he sells out. And
he has a family and a white picket fence. I found learning that through Pete that he ditches that life. Just someone that lives in the suburbs with a family. I'm like, yo, that man abandoned his wife and child.
Yeah.
No, he's a douchebag.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, like,
oh yeah.
Jimmy Gold, oh man, no way. That is not a good dude. But that being stated, I don't know what I was going to say next. I just transitioned to a blank space in my mind.
You know, I think it's interesting. It's an interesting comment that, you know, like these two men who become murderers and rapists and killers, you know, there's no, each of them has a pretty fucked up relationship with their mother in particular. And there's no mention of a father in either. You know, I think Morris's dad dies pretty young. I think that's the case.
Same with Brady's.
Yeah.
He had like a work accident, I think. Yeah.
They're just not in the picture, you know? And so you have these two men in Brady and Morris who so desperately want to be fucking alphas and so desperately want to be Jimmy Gold to the point where they'll fuck their own lives up, you know, to achieve that goal, which they never really achieve anyway.
You know, is there a comment there? And I don't know, this is popping into my head right mm-hmm. now. Maybe Stephen King is saying that, like, hey, kind of takes a village to raise a kid, and single parenthood itself might be part of the reason that these two villains became villains.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see how you couldn't take that into consideration.
And no disrespect to the single parents.
Impossible.
Yeah. If I am not a single parent, mm-mm. can't imagine what it would be like. And I know there are plenty of single parents that are able to rise to that challenge.
Oh my God.
But clearly the single parents in these first two books were not able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, when you're a mother who's, you know, trigger warning for a lack of a better term, sexually assaulting your son, you know, or allowing him to.
We're talking about Mr. Mercedes.
Brady. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like that connection, just like, you know, if that's the background you come from. And also if you come from a background like Morris with a mother who is incredibly selfish and incredibly self-centered, you know, and just like looks at her son as a challenge and looks at her son as, oh, well, I can, you know, let me try to get one up on this kid, you know, through education and through my smarts and being smarter than this child. It's like, dude, it's your fucking son. What the fuck?
Yeah, no wonder he became a jerk.
No fucking wonder. Yeah,
like, you know? Of course.
Yeah, no shit. Yeah. You know?
The person that's supposed to nurture and care for him the most is like, yeah, you're not smart enough. You know what an interesting thing about this book that did give me a little bit in the beginning, like, what's really happening here? Hmm. While I was enjoying every word I read, I'm like, where's Bill?
Yeah.
Where's Holly?
Where's the quartet?
Where's Jerome?
Right.
And they're really, they are consequential to the climax of the book.
Right.
There's a point where all of the pieces of the puzzle are there and they're marching towards the confrontation in the basement in the rec center.
Right.
And so that point feels like this great crescendo, but it's not until like halfway through the book, more or less, that Bill and Holly are even characters.
Yeah.
So my question for you is, how do you think our heroes from the last book, how do you think they fare? Do we learn anything about them in this book that's worth us investigating?
That's a good question. I don't think that. I mean, we learn some things. You know, Bill's obviously in much better health. He's eating better. He's in better shape. But outside of that, no, they feel like secondary characters in this book, which is probably why a lot of the criticism is like, oh, yeah, it's good. But because I think, I don't know, I was missing the quartet for most of it.
I was too.
You know,
I fell really in love with how Bill, Jerome, and Holly were interplaying mm-hmm. with each other. I do feel like a lot of their growth happened in the first book.
Yeah.
So a lot of this book is about the sort of duality between Morris and Pete, and they are more kind of attached to that story rather than it truly being about Bill and his and him being a great detective. Obviously, everything kind of comes to a head and they're where they need to be, but I think you nailed it. They're a supporting cast in
this. Yeah, 100%. 100%. I mean, they're not really used until right before the climax of the book.
And that's where they really matter. And it's really cool that Bill gets to help Pete. And in certain ways, like both Morris and Pete can be Jimmy Gold and be read as Jimmy mm-hmm. Gold. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real interpretation, how these two young men, even though when they meet, one is old and one is still young, but as young men, how they interacted with this material and their relationship to their families.
Yeah.
And those differences where with Morris, it's dysfunctional. With Pete, while his family is dysfunctional, out of his love for his family, he uses this to help heal his family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really think that's the sort of dichotomy. I mean, obviously, Holly is clearly a way more confident, way more competent, woman in this book.
Right.
So like, I feel like she is really good at driving the detective aspect of it. Mm-hmm. It's her instincts. It's her research. Everyone's talking in the car and she's got the iPad finding the clues.
Right.
So I feel like she is emerging as the best detective.
Yeah, she's the sleuth.
She's the one that wants to go talk to the teacher.
Yeah.
You know, and so like it's her instincts that are driving the quartet towards Pete to help solve what's wrong with Pete, which was their mystery. But this book is not what's wrong with Pete.
Right. Correct. I agree with that.
Awesome, man. Well, so we are deep in this. I don't know how long we've been going because I'm not watching the time.
Who knows with us?
Yeah, we've either started 10 minutes ago or we've been doing this for 2 hours.
Yeah, we have no idea.
I'm not sure which it is, but we have not brought up the Dark Tower.
We haven't. Well, we should do that now.
Yeah, so how do you think this book relates and connects to The Dark Tower?
Sure. So I think it's just, I really do think it's an extension of Mr. Mercedes. You know, there's a couple mentions. There's one specific mention of Palaver that I thought was really cool. It doesn't ring. I mean, if we want to pull things, you know, kind of abstractly, you know, you do have a young, you know, three young male characters in Jimmy and Morris and what's his name? Oh my God. We've been saying his name for 2 hours.
Morris, Peter.
Peter.
Yeah.
You know, you have these young men who are driven by this one character, very, very, you know, pull a lot of confidence from that person, pull a lot of the way that they view themselves as a human, the way they view the world through this person. And it, you know, in a way, it does remind me a bit. I mean, it's hard to link this one to the Dark Tower. It's hard. I found myself, other than small mentions, I found my, and Brady's little, like we sort of discover, the one thing that I finally fucking figured out, you know, that Brady's pretty much telepathic at this point after the accident.
You mean telekinetic?
Telekinetic, right, yeah. After the accident.
This is like, if he's telepathic, I totally miss that.
Yeah, no, he's telekinetic. And so, you know, like that feeling, like, that pulled me right into the Dark Tower, this feeling of like, okay, there's something else at work here, like Ka. You know, there's someone or something pulling those strings. But really, I mean, those are the only, like, really key references that I could find.
Yeah, I think people going through an intense physical trauma and emerging more connected to the supernatural, like Susanna loses her legs,
right.
You know, Jake dies and right. gets reborn, and here is Brady, ostensibly brain damaged, but can move things with his mind,
yeah.
is a very Tower-esque theme.
100%.
Like, these horrible things can happen to you, and on the other end, you could be more connected to the supernatural,
yeah.
and whether that's for good or evil, you know, like those are major themes in the Dark Tower in a lot of Stephen King's work, so I mean, I totally picked that up.
And that's the one point in the book that it shifted for me. You know, like when Brady, because the whole time I'm thinking to myself, well, was Brady going to come back? I mean, he fucking woke up. We at the end of the last book, he's got to come back. Something's got to happen. And then when you have those chapters with him, I mean, I just imagine, like, you know, a dark hospital room, and you really get to see, you know, speaking of Bill, you kind of get to see a very, I don't want to say sick, but a very, like, motivated side to him where he wants bad things to happen to Brady. Rightfully so, like I get it, but the things that he says to egg him on, and the fact that Brady's just sitting there the entire time letting it happen, it's wild. It's sick.
We still don't know truly what's up.
What
with
the
Brady.
Fuck is going
like,
on?
If he's hearing that or not? Like we,
right.
So like we don't really know the answer. If Brady's playing a game or what?
Or what's happening?
What degree his powers are? But I do think Roland obsessed with his. I'm sorry. Bill obsessed with his enemy and not being able to let it go,
like
is
Roland
very
does.
Roland-esque.
Yeah. And the man in black. Yeah, like just chasing him over time.
So I have some Dark Tower little nuggets,
yeah.
Easter eggs.
Please.
Some of these are also just Stephen King Easter eggs. So on page 41, there I'll just
if
read
you're
the
reading
book.
The Kindle.
If you're reading the Kindle, it could be different if you have the physical book. So page 41 on the Kindle, they pass the sign reading rest area 2 miles. And Morris thought of Macbeth. If it were to be done, then...
Twere be done quickly?
Yes, thank you. Just brutalize the quote, thank you. Not an exact quote, maybe, but close enough for government work.
Mm.
Eddie Dean's line,
yeah.
who says, close enough for government work.
Yep, yep.
Then there is, and I just passed it, so let me go back to it, page 95 in the Kindle. Aren't you a little doobie? Jack Mort. And Annie Wilkes have that saying.
The doobies.
The yep. doobies and don'tbees. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Let me skip that note here. So this is another one. Maybe it's subtle. This is about the guy that owns the bookstore. So the guy that owns the bookstore is a lot like a dark version of Calvin Tower.
Mm-hmm.
He is overweight.
Yep.
He's obsessed with books.
He owns a bookstore.
Mm-hmm. So the guy in...
A rare bookstore.
The guy in Finder's Keepers, he's a homosexual,
mm-hmm.
whereas Calvin Tower seems a little sexless,
mm-hmm.
right? He's not
asexual.
Like he's just obsessed with owning his books
yeah.
and is not interested in love, but there's a little bit of like not coded heterosexual
right.
in Calvin Tower. And yeah. clearly I forget the guy's name in Finder's Keepers. I'm blanking on mm-hmm. the name. It's Andrew?
It might be.
Yeah, but whatever.
We'll say Andrew.
So a little overweight, Calvin Tower, little sleazy, gets in with the mob. Mm-hmm. The guy in Finders Keepers, a little sleazy and has a bit of a bad reputation, neither of which are successful at selling books.
Right.
You know, so like, I think there's definitely an overlap between those two characters. And I'll just read this one quick quote here, but I got to make it bigger. Outside the bookstore, a long table had been set up beneath an awning. Spring cleaning, the sign said. Everything on this table, 70% off. Mm. And below it, who knows what buried treasure you will find. This line was flanked by big yellow smiley faces to show it was a joke, but Pete didn't think it was funny. So the idea of this big jokey sign, like the restaurant of the mind, I got a vibe from that.
The smiley face that Brady...
The smiley faces are a callback to Mr. Mm-hmm. Mercedes mm-hmm. for certain. So I feel like there is a connection between Calvin Tower and that guy there whose name I forgot. This is a quote of Julius Caesar's. I'll bring that up later if there's time. Oh, so you mentioned there's a Julius Caesar quote in this. And if there's time, I'll bring it up because I noted that. Absolutely.
Shocking.
So you mentioned palaver. Okay, on page 299. Yeah. Robinson tops his glass and sips it as he considers. Morris wouldn't want to be the owner of the bike Charlie is going to be putting back down once the little palaver is done.
Yep.
So there's the palaver, which is how they talk about a conversation. Why is my Kindle freezing?
And like a very intent conversation.
Yes. A mention about the trees when Morris is digging out the trees. Digging out the
trunks
for the trunk in the trees. The trees are runty, which is a callback to the wolves of the Cala and the kids who come back, quote unquote, runt.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a tower reference, but Hodges ambles down the hall toward room 217, where that is where Brady is. 217 is the same room in the book, but not the movie, The Shining. So there's that. So there's another thing that happens when Morris shifts into just outright manic villainy. And the language that's used specifically by Stephen King is that he becomes like the big bad wolf. Even then, when Morris is teetering on the edge, and his parole officer comes, he's just like, you're not a wolf. You know, essentially calling him a coward. He's emasculating him. Mm-hmm. He's telling him, you'll never be a hunter. You'll never be an alpha. And as his lips get red, his teeth get sharp, he takes on this wolf-like persona. And I think that's to harken back to the big bad wolf in the Grimm fairy tale. Or the fairy tale might not be a Grimm fairy tale. I'm blanking on where that fairy tale came from. That's hearkening back also to the Wolves of the Talisman.
Sure, sure.
But it also reminds me of something else. And, oh my God, did I get the quote? I built this up here. How his lips become red.
Mm-hmm.
And while that is also wolf-like.
They become thin and pursed.
No, he specifically notates the redness.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Do you know who consistently has red lips in the Dark Tower?
No.
Man in Black.
Oh, yeah, okay. Okay.
Constantly described with these bright red lips.
Sure.
You know, so like, and so he's got these bright red lips, his manic laughter, his delight in the torture and killing. And his desire to orchestrate these grand schemes where everyone falls into place and kills feels very much like the Man in Black.
And the madness of him trying to douse the flames in the end of, and like lighting himself on fire.
Right. Except for his lips, which are weirdly red. That's the quote. I found it. Okay.
Yeah.
It was in my notes. His notes. So I feel like as we see Morris, what do we know? The theories of the Man in Black. There's several of who is he? Is he one person? Are they several people? Mm-hmm. Is it Randall Flagg from The Stand? Are they the same as Flagg from Eyes of the Dragon? And all of these great fan theories that exist out there. Well, one of them is that the original Man in Black left his family as a teenage boy and was raped, anally raped several times.
Right.
And that was sort of his start into villainy. Well, what happens to Morris when he goes to jail? To jail. He gets raped quite a bit. So that's another subtle connection there. So I feel like I'm just making sure. Oh, one other little one, page 538. I believe Morris said this. I should have put this in the notes. Hold on. Let me confirm. No. So this is Bill saying this to Brady as he leaves. One of the last times he sees him, see you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile, which is something that Blaine the Mono says to the Cottet in the Wastelands.
Sure.
So that's about all the little Easter eggs.
Man, it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot for a short book.
Yeah, man.
How the fuck do I not pick up on half of these? I was like, palaver. Yay.
That's definitely in my notes, too.
I got my one tower reference, you fuck.
I will tell you why. And I it's very, very simple. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with our degrees. You got a degree in acting.
Yeah, that's true.
I got a degree in history.
Yeah. You're going to remember the minute details a little bit better.
The history is about looking through the text and finding everything you need to know about it, highlighting, going back. And like that is something that I was trained to do when I went to school, which is why I'm good at that.
I mean, that
part.
Makes sense.
That's all it is.
That makes sense. Constantly talk about how I feel.
Yes. Someone asked me how I feel, and I'm like,
I feel alive.
I'm good. Can we move on to the next point now? I feel good. Let's go on.
I'll give you a dissertation.
Yeah.
What's the Julius Caesar quote?
Speaking of being a historian, yeah. So there was a Julius Caesar quote. I believe it was Morris's. Bear with me. I'm scrolling back
That would make sense.
This is great, man. So Julius Caesar is responsible for a lot of little quotes and things like that. And a lot of times people aren't aware of them. So, oh no, this is Pete that thinks this. So Pete slips his cell back into the pocket of his chinos. A phrase from his freshman Latin pops into his head. It's a scary one in any language, but it fits the situation perfectly. I'm going to brutalize the Latin. Alea iacta est. The die is cast. Okay. Mm-hmm. Julius Caesar, he wrote this in his own memoirs. I believe, I have to fact check that myself, but it was either written of him or he wrote it himself. Mm-hmm. When he crossed the Rubicon, which is the river that separates ancient Gaul from ancient Roman territory. Mm-hmm. Gaul is modern day France. The ancient Roman territory stopped right around the end of modern Italian territory. So when he marched his army into Rome to go seize the capital from Pompey, starting a civil war, he said, the die is cast, meaning that there's no going back. I'm going in. It's civil war, which ultimately Caesar does win. And that's why when we talk of salads, we don't call them Pompeys. We call them Caesars. Caesar.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that's a little Caesar quote I had to get back.
Yeah, I was going to say. You brought that up. We're like, we have to get that in.
Caesar quote I highlighted. Put that in the notes. Like, we're talking Julius Caesar here. You know?
So one thing we have to discuss here at the end, because we didn't actually do it. We usually have ended these post-Dark Tower podcasts with the question, and I'll ask you first this time. In your ranking of books, where would you put Finders Keepers?
Not compared to The Dark Tower.
Right. The other Stephen King books that we've read.
The way I'm currently looking at this is there are the Stephen King books that kind of get in my bones. You know what I mean? Like that the characters live with me.
Yeah.
Stuttering Bill. Bevy from the Levee, Roland Deschain,
Richie Tozier.
You know, these characters that like really reverberate and live rent-free in my head. And I do feel like by the time this trilogy is over, Bill and Holly can get up there for
me. Yeah, I think so too.
But they're not there yet.
Yeah, I agree. They're really good books. But I don't think they're great. They're not for me. For me, in terms of things like Salem's Lot and It and 11/22/63, which to this day might be one of the best books I've ever read, thinking about it. They're good books. But when Stephen King makes an attempt at a different style, of course it's going to be good. But it doesn't live like these. Holly lives rent-free in my brain. Of all of them.
Which is probably why she goes beyond this trilogy.
I think that's the thing. I think King created her and really fell in love with that character. Holly, that book came out, 2 years ago? Not even?
Yeah, pretty recent.
You know? So I think, for me personally, it's probably on the lower end. You know? It's not bad.
It's hard for me to judge mid-trilogy, too.
I know.
Is that fair? Like, is that a cop-out?
No, it's not. Because I look at it two different ways. I can look at it as a single book, standalone, but also you have to look at it as a trilogy because this book really is a true middle. It's a connecting book, and it's meant to be. It's not meant to be anything else other than that. At least I don't think so.
I think the commentary and thought process about having two different fans, one that goes insane and one that helps, is really interesting, especially from a Stephen King fan perspective. I think interrogating toxic fandom and toxic masculinity and how those go hand in hand is a really important theme. I feel that this will never be, this will very likely be, by the time we do the third book, I'm going to say, I'm really glad I did this, but I will tell you one thing. If I'm ever in I want to have a fun book and I want to read it and have a good time, this series is something I could go back to. Like, Misery may be a quote unquote better book from a critical lens.
Sure.
I will never read that book
right,
again.
Right.
Right. The Stand is easily a better book from a quote-unquote critical lens.
I probably won't read it again.
Odds are I'll never read that again.
Now, I plan to read again.
When I'm ready.
Yeah. Well,
I definitely do want to read it again.
We got a lot to read.
Yes. But it's also, I need to be ready to go. To go through that again. It's a world I want to go back into, knowing how complicated and weird and fucked up it is.
Yeah.
I do want to go, I do go back to the Dark Tower, complicated and weird and fucked up, right? So I could see myself, what I'm trying to say is, this is the most fun, pure just fun, I've had doing Stephen King in a while. And what I've loved about being a Stephen King fan is it's not always fun. It makes me really look at myself in the mirror, maybe look at humanity a little differently, maybe wonder, challenge some of the assumptions. Like, a core thing of a lot of Stephen King characters is they feel like their philosophy, the way they look at the world, they know it, it works, there's no problem with it, and then in comes something magical that says the way you look at the world is completely
backwards.
Wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so Stephen King is constantly reminding me to challenge my assumptions and my beliefs and say that, you know, the world and universe or multiverse can be stranger than even I could imagine.
Yeah.
And I am enjoying reading books that are just fun.
Yeah. Oh, me too.
You know, like,
absolutely.
I'm just having a good time reading them.
Yeah.
Having a good time talking about them. Mm-hmm. We almost ended the podcast before we did the Misery because I didn't know if I even wanted to talk about it.
And it is interesting because there is a part of me, you know, I mean, we read Stephen King full time. That shit's tough. You know, like, it does get to a point where it does weigh on you. And I will admit that this is one of those books where it felt like watching a detective movie. That I'm moving with the action. You know, that the action is what's driving this book, not necessarily the themes or the characters or the universe affecting what's happening, you know. And we talk about this constantly. We're always going to look at Stephen King novels from the Tower perspective and not from a constant reader, even though we bridge the gap. At this point.
Yeah, at this point, what's the difference?
Honestly, but we do, the one thing that as I'm reading that I think does kind of separate that mindset from just reading him as an author is that we are looking for the tower. I'm always looking for it. Always. You know, and though half the time I don't find the really minute details, that's also just me as a person. You know, I still enjoy being in his world because I know that my one foot is always on the level of the tower.
Well said, dude.
Always with him. If at any point in time, I mean, even the books that we really have to look, it never feels made up. It never feels bullshit. Like, I feel like the tower is truly in every single one of his books. And this is a prime example.
Yeah, man. I think that's really, really well said.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I know. All good, man. I think that's really well said. And I connect to that on a very deep and primal level because the Dark Tower means so much to me.
Yeah.
And recently I've been asking myself why. And I've been really trying to figure out what it is about the Dark Tower that gripped me so much that it stopped me from reading history and philosophy, which I have spent from the time I was 18 till the time I was like 5 years ago when we started this podcast.
Yeah.
I read all the time and it was only history and philosophy.
Yeah.
I would not even think about reading something else except for it was actually George R. R. Martin, Game of Thrones, that kind of prepped the way. So I did do the Song of Ice and Fire books. But what is it about the Dark Tower? And I think in the Dark Tower, the character Roland has this unwavering belief in the tower and that can heal not just him, but the universe.
Yeah.
And I do think in a very real way, Bill Hodges carries that energy. He's broken. He's old. But yet his belief in the white, his belief in making sure that justice is done, healed his body literally from a heart attack, has helped heal Holly and give her purpose, has helped shape Jerome and now Jerome's sister Barbara.
Yeah.
And there's this idea that no matter what age you are, no matter what you went through in the past, no matter what circumstances and crimes you may have committed wrong, you may have hurt people in the past, but you can still go out there and do good.
Yeah, I love that about
Roland. I love that about Bill.
I mean, Roland loses Susan. Bill loses, what is her name? I always forget her name.
Oh, his girlfriend in the first book?
In the first book. We're terrible at names. Everybody knows this. We know
who she is. Make your point. I'm going to Google it.
Well, my point being that, like, if we're connecting these older men, these male roles as characters in these books, Roland and Bill are very similar. You know, they lose the love of their life to a decision that they made. This person is sacrificed because they made a decision not to be, you know, like Roland, like not speaking up for Susan, or like Bill, not getting in that car. So, you know, I think sometimes I get lost in the literal connections to the tower. And sometimes I don't look at the things like Bill and Roland being very similar. Jake and Peter being very similar, if you ask me. You know, these young boys that he writes, you know, just being so similar to Jake, and all of these characters taking a page out of a book from one of our quartet, you know. And that was the thing I missed the most in this book, was the quartet.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I mean, it doesn't feel like they're there for a reason and they feel justified. I just want them more.
I almost feel like they did the character work in the last book.
Yeah.
And this book is not about their character journey.
At all. It's not. They really, there's no development. Like, it doesn't push their character arc forward in any way. Bill slightly because of his connection with Brady, and Jerome slightly. Holly is clearly growing. You know, I mean, she runs Finders Keepers. It's basically her organization, which makes sense. You know, but I think...
Janie,
yes. Oh, thank God. Okay. My God. I'm terrible with names. Like, I see her. Like, the character that I see faces, I'm great with faces, terrible with names.
Not to mention, though, we read a lot of these
books.
There's
so many fucking characters, and they all have the same names.
And our day job is remembering people.
Seriously, it's hard.
We do it our day job.
It's hard.
So there's only so much space in the memory, right? Yeah. So give ourselves a little grace.
And the medical, you know, the medical marijuana prescription doesn't help.
With remembering names?
No.
No, but it does help.
Oh, it helps.
Oh, it helps.
Oh, helps
just
big
not
time.
With just not with names.
Just not with that part.
Just not with names. But it helps.
Dude, I don't know about you. That's what I got.
Yeah,
for
man.
This book.
So we kind of danced around it, but like, where would you rank Finders Keepers?
Yeah, it's towards the bottom.
Towards
me.
The bottom.
Yeah, the reason why is that if I'm connecting it to the way that I feel about the tower and the tower's influence on it, and in terms of my interest in it, it's around insomnia. Like I definitely liked Mr. Mercedes just a little bit more than this one. Not that I disliked it, but I would put it towards the bottom for me in what we've read.
So when you read Catcher in the Rye in high school, how much did you feel like Holden whatever his name is?
Oh, pretty hard.
And yet, you didn't get...
I was a kid.
Yeah, but so are these two characters. Yeah. They were kids.
Yeah.
They're reading Holden Caulfield. Catcher in the Rye.
I never... But for me, you know, I connected more to characters in songs than I did in books when I was a kid.
Oh, that's fair.
So there are specific songs that I could go to, that there are characters within those songs that I felt very connected to. I, full disclosure, as a kid, I didn't read as much as I do as an adult.
Yeah, neither did I. That's fair too. Yeah. So this is another one of the one-offs where I finished the book before you.
Yeah,
didn't I?
You did.
Yeah,
I did. By about a week.
I?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm having a hard time officially placing this one because I think what you're saying makes sense. And I think if I am being a critical attempt at dispassionate observer of Stephen King's work,
which is what this part is,
it would be on the lower scale. If I talk about me subjectively and what I loved this book.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved the reconciliation of adolescent grief and trauma and anger and angst and how one character overcomes it and one character succumbs to it.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of myself in both Pete and Morris.
Sure.
In strange ways. I'm like, there's a world where I could have become a Morris and just become a bad dude because a lot of people I grew up with became Morrises.
Sure.
You know, not necessarily stone cold killers, but became really bad, terrible people.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of people that became Pete's, and I feel like I'm still working my way to be more like Pete. So like subjectively, I saw so much of me in these two characters, how they relate to literature, how I relate to art. And so I really, really dug that. I am so into Bill and Holly as characters. Yeah. So yeah, I'm just like a fan.
Well, and
so
that's why I think
fanboy when they're there at this point. You
that's kind of why I like this question and this segment of this podcast, because typically I don't really like to rank things. Like I know what I like, I know what I don't like, but I do think it's interesting to look at it critically because we very clearly fucking love Stephen King. Like it's very clear that we love him, but I do like this one moment of, okay, if we're going to be critical, where would it fall?
So in terms of fun, personal enjoyment of Stephen King,
it's up there.
Both of these two books.
Yeah.
have just been at the top.
Yeah.
Both of these books were books where I was, is my alarm off yet? Well, let me check.
Yeah.
Oh, my alarm's going to go off in 15 minutes. Let me go up and read.
Let me just, yeah.
Like both of these books I had that experience with, and it's been a while. Mm-hmm. So while I admit some of the books that we have read are better, I was not as into it as this.
Sure.
So like Pure Fan, Pure Fan, I feel like very at the top.
Yeah.
Critical Lens, middle bottom.
Sure. That makes sense. I mean, and that's the thing. I don't think this book is meant to be at the top of anybody's. And if it is, awesome. Because it's still a really good book.
Oh, yeah. And everyone can have their own journey with it, right?
Like, it's subjective.
So our lists are not to say your list, if you disagree with us out there, audience is wrong.
Please.
Like, if this is your favorite Stephen King book, one, I love you. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Two, hit us up on the socials.
And let us know.
Tell us why.
What is your favorite Stephen King book?
Yeah.
You know, and why? You know, for me, it's been it because it literally broke me in my fucking trauma of my fear of clowns. You know, like things like that. But it doesn't have to be that dramatic and that big all the time for it to be one of your favorite pieces.
Right. Some Stephen King books I've read have been transformational experiences that have changed the trajectory of my life. Mm-hmm. Like The Dark Tower leading to this podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you and I starting out as neighbors and friends, uh-huh, becoming brothers.
Yeah.
Over our love of The Dark Tower.
Yeah.
You know, so much so that you are Arthur's godfather. Yeah. you know, like my son is Arthur.
And you know, whose middle name is literally, you know, Roland, is literally named after him.
So not all Stephen King is going to do that.
Yeah.
You know, which is why I don't compare books to The Dark Tower, because that's not fair.
Right.
But I just think from someone that really needs this right, like this is the right books for me
at
this right time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for that, I'm always going to have nothing but respect and love for what artists do when they sit around and look at a computer screen, a notebook, a chalkboard, whatever that process is, and create these things whole cloth, and how much that can change how someone like me can, mm-hmm, make my life feel more fulfilled and can help me become a better version of myself. I know it's really cheesy,
but
help me become a better person, a better fan, someone who has a more open mind, someone that...
Christ, this made me a better father.
I know.
What not to do as a parent. Thank you, Stephen King. How not to act.
Let's try loving and hugging them.
You know, maybe that works.
Yeah. So all of this is to say, I am so into this journey. So what comes next? We're going to finish the trilogy, right?
What is the third book?
Endwatch, I think. Ending Watch. I have to look it up.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
Yeah. Man, there are some Stephen King diehards out there that hearing this must be so mad at us. Like,
why do you guys even have a podcast if you're not even going to get the title of the fucking book right?
So we're going to read the third book. I haven't downloaded it yet.
I'm probably going to do it tonight.
Yeah, I'm reading another book.
So am I.
Not Stephen King
so
related.
Am I.
But it's very short.
What are you reading?
Oh, we're reading the same book.
Oh, are we?
Yes, because I might have bought it for you. Yeah. We're reading a book by a motivational speaker named Damon West called The Locker Room.
Oh yeah, I'm almost finished that.
Yeah.
Then technically I'm reading two books right now.
Oh, what's your other book?
I'm reading the Neil Gaiman version of Norse mythology.
Oh, nothing wrong with that.
That I actually won from the Midnight Myth like 3 years ago.
Yeah, before we were doing this?
It was before.
Yeah.
And I read it, but I'm rereading it. Little palate cleanser.
You know, I have that totally off topic as an audiobook. And every once in a while, I love
it. He does it, right?
He does it.
Yeah, that makes sense. He's brilliant.
He is great at it.
He's another one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Neil Gaiman. Is it Gaiman or Gaiman?
I go back and forth because I don't know.
Is it DePape or DePape?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Tomato, tomato.
Well, anything else you got, dude?
I got nothing, man.
All right, fellow travelers on the path of the beam, Wheel of Ka, we will see you next time. Until then, long days and pleasant nights.
Long days and pleasant nights.